KPCW News. Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Well, it's a little bit brisk this morning. Let's find out what we have in store for our weather today and for the weekend. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. Here's a look at your forecast for your Friday afternoon for the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at overall decent conditions. We'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies. High temperatures climbing into the upper 50s in Park City today. We should climb into the low 60s, of course, across the Heber Valley. As we go into tonight, we'll be looking at partly cloudy skies. Temperatures dropping to near 40 in Park City. We'll see those temperatures dropping down to around the 40-degree mark as well in the Heber Valley. High temperatures for your Saturday. They climb into the low 60s in Park City. We'll be in the upper 60s for the Heber Valley. We'll see clouds on the increase and a chance of a few afternoon showers and storms developing. As we go into your Saturday night, showers and thunderstorms become likely across the area. A couple of those storms could have some high gusty winds out there. Overnight lows will drop down to near 40 degrees. We've got a much cooler day on the way for your Sunday with unsettled weather conditions with scattered showers and a couple of rumbles of thunder, especially in the morning and by the afternoon hours. Some of those thunderstorms could turn over to some snow showers, especially for elevations above 7,000 feet. High temperatures in Park City will only be in the mid-40s as we go throughout our Sunday afternoon, with highs only in the low 50s for the Heber Valley. As we go into your Monday, we're going to continue with these unsettled weather conditions. Temperatures starting off around the freezing mark in both Park City and the Heber Valley. As we go throughout the day on your Monday, high temperatures only in the mid-40s for Park City. Highs will be into the low to mid-50s for the Heber Valley. We'll still keep a chance of a few isolated showers in the forecast. As we head into the rest of next week, though, we've got lots of sunshine returning across the area. And while it does start off on the chilly side, we will see a warming trend with high temperatures back into the 60s by next Tuesday and Wednesday in the Park City. Highs will be in the 60s in the Heber Valley on Tuesday. Highs will be in the mid-70s by the time we get towards your Wednesday. We're all in the 70s by the time we get towards the end of next week. From the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up in a few minutes, I'm going to be speaking with Drs. Colton Miller and Sean Miller about an upcoming mental health awareness presentation. Jeremy Rubel will then stop by the studio with a debrief on last night's city council meeting, and we'll finish our hour by speaking with Ty Hunter about boating safety as the spring boating season arrives. Stay tuned. Well, finalists for Park City's five-acre development project have pitched their best ideas for a new district at the intersection of Bonanza Drive and Kearns Boulevard. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
The two final developers that Park City is considering for the five-acre parcel were interviewed by the City Council during a special meeting Wednesday. Both proposals include affordable housing, a new home for the Kimball Arts Center, local retail, community open space, art elements, and enhanced pedestrian connections. First up to present was Illinois-based Brinshore Development, which recently completed the Astor and Spark Apartment projects in Salt Lake City. Brinshore's proposal includes 156 affordable housing units, over 300 spaces of underground parking, and a linear art walk running through the middle of the property. The proposed site also includes space for local retail, a child care center, co-working spaces, a gym, and a stage for concerts. The maximum building heights proposed are 45 feet. Brinshore estimated the total project cost at around $120 million. Park City has set a $30 million contribution for the development, which is in addition to the $19 million it paid for the property in 2017. Brinshore said they would utilize low-income housing tax credits to fund the project. The company estimated they could begin a two-year construction period in March 2027. Park City Councilmember Ryan Dickey asked if they would consider including some market-rate housing.
They can sort of promote the general upkeep of a project to have some market rate in it.
Brinshore officials said they are open to including some market-rate units. The second developer to present was Salt Lake City-based Woodbury Corporation and its affiliate, Pinnacle Real Estate. Woodbury highlighted their recent University Place project in Orem, which they said is a popular community gathering space and a hub for local entrepreneurs. The company is proposing more than 170 units of affordable housing for the Bonanza Park property, along with local retail, offices, and 275 parking stalls, mostly underground. The site plan also includes green spaces, room for an amphitheater, a fitness center, fire pits, and a similar art walk concept. Buildings would be four stories high, however, an exact height was not listed in the presentation. Woodbury did not present a projected total cost nor a construction timeline. While company officials said they could pursue low-income housing tax credits, they don't want to completely rely on the program due to its uncertainty. Park City Councilmember Ed Parisian called out the developer for misspelling a nearby road in its presentation.
Get your streets right. I know you only had a month to do this, but it's Prospector Ave. It's not Prospect Drive.
Woodbury's slide deck included several other typos, including misspellings of acres, aerial, pedestrian, and cornhole. The Park City Council went into closed session after the two interviews. It's unclear when a final decision could be made about the property. See conceptual renderings and more details of both development proposals online at kpcw.org. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
MIDA plans to budget about $274 million for its public infrastructure district in and around East Village in fiscal year 2026. KPCW's Grace Duffler reports.
MIDA is the Military Installation Development Authority, a state agency originally formed to serve veterans and military members. It's governed by appointed, not elected officials. MIDA is involved in much of the development in northern Wasatch County, including Deer Valley East Village and new neighborhoods on the western shore of the Jordanelle Reservoir. It has a Public Infrastructure District, or PID, responsible for things like roads and utilities on the land west of US 40. PIDs are a way for developers to build infrastructure using bonds, and they're governed by their own boards. The bonds are later repaid through special assessments or property taxes, so property owners in the district could be charged extra to cover the cost. On Tuesday, the Mountain Village Public Infrastructure District approved a $274 million tentative budget for fiscal year 2026. That's down from last year's $324 million budget. The tentative budget includes $2.7 million for operations and over $230 million for project costs, including capital projects like a snow melting facility and a salt storage facility. It also includes $35 million in debt service. Heather Cruz is the executive director of MIDA's presence in Wasatch County. She says administrators are making a map of the infrastructure.
We have been working on creating an interactive map for the public infrastructure district, so we will be able to pinpoint each and every piece of the inventory, asset inventory. So we can look at lights, we can look at different pieces of the stormwater network, things like that, which will help us with maintenance and operations.
Cruz says as East Village developer Extel finishes construction projects, it is turning over infrastructure management to the PID. Deer Valley had a grand opening for the first phase of its resort expansion in January, with more terrain and amenities expected to open in the 2025-26 season. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Park City Hospital is hosting a mental health awareness event this coming Tuesday. On the phone to tell us about it, we have PhD psychologist Colton Miller with Intermountain Psychiatry and Counseling Clinic and Sean Miller with Solstice Counseling and Wellness Center. Good morning, gentlemen, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Great to be here.
Okay. Colton, let me ask you, why did you guys decide to team up and hold this event?
So this is the second time that we have teamed up to do an event like this. We did one last year specifically about ADHD. Sean and myself are part of an APA accredited internship program. So we have essentially doctoral residents or interns working under our supervision, and part of their internship is to do outreach and community presentations in order to share information with the community and topics that are kind of in the news, and so we can spread correct information and educate those who are willing to listen.
Okay, I understand you guys plan to highlight three common conditions: autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, and OCD. Well, you know, those terms get tossed around a lot. I'm not sure people really understand what each of these conditions are. Sean, let me start with you. Can you sort of explain, you know, the scope of the concept of autism spectrum disorder?
Actually, I was going to hope to talk about OCD.
You get to pick your disorder, Sean. So, Colton, you want to take on the autism one?
That sounds great. Yeah, I'll start there. So those three disorders are all in the DSM, and they're mental health conditions that we, both Sean and I, work with basically on a daily basis. The reason we chose those three is because they fall under a broader category of neurodivergence. Neurodivergence essentially means that it's just a different way that people's brains work. It's not bad. It's not necessarily deficient or disabled. It's just different. And so specifically to autism, there's a lot to say, but autism spectrum disorder means that there are people with different abilities and functional ability in three different levels. The folks who I tend to work with are what's considered level one. We used to call that high functioning, and it used to even be further back 10 years ago was called Asperger's. Mm-hmm. But now we just kind of call it level one autism spectrum disorder. And so their brains are wired differently. They experience their environments differently. They process information in unique ways. And what's really neat about this is many of these individuals are completely functional. They, and in many ways, they're more advanced than what we would call us neurotypical people. And so I really enjoy working with neurodiverse people. And autism, I think, in my opinion, has actually advanced the human race in ways that we can't, you know, that have benefited all of us in numerous ways, which we'll talk about more later.
Okay, is autism a condition where you have actually the concept of treatment? And what would the treatment options be?
Great question. So we don't actually treat autism per se, okay? Maybe in children, there's ABA therapy, which is somewhat controversial mm-hmm. because it used to be based in trying to train neurodiverse children into being more neurotypical. Well, we've learned over time that that's not always very helpful. So the movement in autism, quote, treatment now is to embrace their neurodiversity and to celebrate it and to focus on their strengths and put them in situations in which they can flourish rather than trying to make them into something that they're not, their brain is not wired to be. So when I work with somebody who's neurodiverse, I'm not treating their autism. We might be talking about social skills. We may be talking about emotional regulation. We may be talking about accommodations they can implement at the workplace or at home or at school in order to help them be successful. Just one quick example, many neurodiverse people or people on the autism spectrum may struggle with sensory sensitivities. Mm-hmm. So like certain lights, sounds, textures, foods, clothing can really, really bother them. And so we work on creating a plan in which they can thrive in an environment that works for them rather than them always trying to adapt to a neurotypical environment.
And that sort of raises a parallel question, which is, you know, as we go through life, you often run into people and you can sort of in sense that there might be some neurodivergence going on. What are some tips for being sensitive and dealing with people who might be on the spectrum or have the Asperger condition?
Yeah, so we always want to be careful about making assumptions about, exactly. You know, people's brain wiring. But with that said, I always encourage my patients to be more self-disclosing rather than trying to mask or hide their neurodiversity. And so somebody who's on the autism spectrum, if they're willing to tell you, hey, I'm neurodiverse and this is what it means to me, and they might tell you, you know, I really don't do well in an office with fluorescent lighting. Well, we should probably work to create an accommodation for them. What I'd ultimately say is we should treat everybody the same with respect and dignity and not talk down to them or think that they're not understanding us. In fact, what's fascinating that we know about like level two and level three individuals, particularly level three individuals who may be nonverbal, is their brains are more advanced than most of ours and they understand everything completely. They're just not able to communicate effectively back. There are ways that we can do that through computers and AI now. But essentially, we should never assume anything about anybody's intellect if they're autistic or their functional ability. The cliche is if you've met one person on the spectrum, you've still only met one person.
Yes.
That's why we call it a spectrum.
Let's go ahead and, Sean, let's talk a little bit about OCD. What is obsessive compulsive disorder and how do we see it manifested?
Yeah, so obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD, as it's commonly described, can be generally understood, right, as a doubting disorder. Unfortunately, OCD is often a long-lasting disorder in which a person has uncontrollable, reoccurring, intrusive thoughts. We refer to these as the obsessions and behaviors which constitute the compulsions, and they have the urge to repeat them over and over and over again. True clinical OCD is far beyond what people joke about when they say they have OCD, like being super neat, clean, and organized. It's an experience of mental distress with symptoms waxing and waning in severity that can be very debilitating. It's important to recognize that OCD is not simply a personality quirk or a lack of willpower. It's a complex and multifaceted disorder that requires understanding, support, and appropriate treatment. It's not uncommon for people to experience persistent persistent unwanted thoughts or have particular routines. However, the diagnosis of OCD is made only when there's significant mental distress or considerable disruption and dysfunction in their everyday life. OCD is often first experienced as a child or adolescent and can disrupt a student's ability to attend school, participate in classroom activities, and engage in learning.
And again, you obviously there's a process for identifying what I would call true OCD. How does that process work, and what are the treatment options to sort of assist people in sort of normal daily living?
Yeah, I mean, you know, essentially what happens is people experience a memory, an urge, or an impulse, and that creates an intrusive thought, which then leads to that obsession. There's often some meaning attached to that obsession. This creates a lot of distress for the individual, and then they're led to some sort of compulsory act to try and mitigate, you know, that distress that they're under. That provides a temporary relief. However, that's very short term and, you know, often leads to long-term suffering. So, you know, there's a couple of different treatment modalities used to help folks, you know, deal with their OCD. SSRIs have shown to be somewhat effective in doing so, right? Often the coupling of different coping techniques and tools like SSRIs, medications,
Stop you because I know I don't know what those initials stand for. What is SSRI?
Yeah, it's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor medication. And so, you know, basically there's a genetic component we're seeing relative to experiencing OCD, and these medications help that individual to cope.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, as far as a psychologist and how we help folks, essentially it's an exposure to the situation that creates that initial, you know, distress and obsession, and then response prevention. We often create like a hierarchy. So working from least distressing situations or thoughts to, you know, more intense.
And is OCD, is that the kind of thing that typically manifests itself at a young age, or can it develop in you know, as people age as well?
You know, like I mentioned there earlier, it is often first experienced in child and adolescence, right. Often within school environments. We see the greatest prevalence rates of OCD among, you know, young adults, 18 adults. To 44 years of age. It often tends to trail off a little bit, you know, based upon the information that we have.
And I don't know which of you wants to take on ADHD, but how is that related to OCD?
So they're all disorders that are considered, again, neurodiverse. Essentially what that means is an individual who has ADHD or OCD or autism, what we just say is that their brain is wired differently. So ADHD, essentially what happens there, and well, let me back up a little further. There are three types of ADHD. There's inattentive type. So these individuals would struggle with like focus, concentration, daydreaming, starting tasks, finishing tasks, making decisions, et cetera, okay? Mm-hmm. There's hyperactive impulsive type. So this is what I think most people think of when they hear about ADHD, is that little kid who has behavioral issues, who's bouncing off the walls in school, who won't sit down, who won't pay attention, who may talk over you. And the third type of ADHD is actually a combination of the first two. Inattentive and hyperactive impulsive, right? And so the relationship is simply the brain wiring is different, but they are very different disorders that manifest differently between OCD and ADHD.
And again, let's talk about treatment options for ADHD.
What the research is showing is that when it comes to ADHD, psychotropic medications is the primary source of relief for a lot of people. And so typically people look for a stimulant medication. And so they would need to meet with a medical provider, specifically a psychiatrist would be probably best, but those are limited, and so it's hard to get into them. But they're typically prescribed a stimulant. And some people might say, well, why would you give somebody who's hyperactive a stimulant? Well, actually what it does in theory, from what we can gather, is the stimulant medication supplies enough dopamine to the brain where the brain is not looking for external sources of dopamine or stimulation. So it actually slows them down in a way where they can focus and concentrate. What's really neat, I think, about specifically about OCD and ADHD is in psychology and psychiatry, we have really good ways of treating and helping people benefit. Whereas some other disorders are a little bit more complicated to treat. And so an individual who presents with ADHD or OCD, I always get excited to work with them, because I truly believe and have seen
that we have ways to really benefit and help them where they may not have received treatment beforehand.
Okay. Can you share a little bit about how the program will work on Tuesday? What will the presentations be like? How long will it last? And who should attend?
We welcome anybody to attend who has interest in this topic of neurodiverseness or neurodiversity. So anybody can attend. It's not designed for anybody specifically. It is free. It'll be at the Intermountain Blair Education Center, which is in the Park City Hospital. We'll begin at around 6 p.m. Actually, we'll begin on time. And then we'll do about an hour of presentation where our three doctoral interns will be taking about 20 minutes on each of these topics. And then we'll do about a 30-minute question and answer with Dr. Sean Miller and myself on the panel with the three doctoral interns to answer any questions that people may have. It's a relaxed time. It's informal. We'd love to have a good turnout.
And once again, this is 6 o'clock on Tuesday, which is in the Blair Educational Center, which I believe is right on the first floor of the Park City Hospital. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Anything else you guys want to add before we go?
I just say it's lovely that Intermountain can team up with Sean's clinic there in Heber City. We've got to have five individuals with doctorate degrees to be able to present free, I think, is a unique opportunity. We love talking about these things, and we welcome everybody to come.
Okay, gentlemen, thanks for spending time with us this morning. Colville City Council members have backed off their attempt to gain the authority to hire and fire the city attorney. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports residents are pleased the council listened, and the mayor keeps that control.
The Colville City Council meeting last Monday felt conciliatory after numerous contentious meetings about employee policies. Council members backpedaled after they presented new city code that put the council in charge of hiring and firing the city attorney and a new role, strategic planner, not the mayor. Councilmember Lynn Wood presented a revised ordinance May 12th, under which Mayor Mark Marsh retains control of the attorney position.
I was realizing how important the city attorney position is for the city council, but I kind of had blinders on. And I think that was one good thing that came out of the public comments.
The ordinance passed 4-1 after Councilmember Brandon Brady asked for the strategic planner position to be appointed by the mayor too, not the city council. He still voted no after the change was added in because he wanted to have more discussion. Wood and Councilmember Louise Willoughby wanted to pass the ordinance before the scheduled budget discussion, also May 12th. Until now, Colville has been using default personnel policies set out in state law with no city-specific code on the books. Residents who gave public input before the vote were happy to see city processes codified, and they thanked the city council for listening to feedback in past meetings. Resident Rory Swinson was one who raised concerns about the separation of legislative and executive powers before.
You know, I had pointed words a few meetings ago, and I think it's only fair to say kudos.
Resident Tom Moore says he attended most of the recent discussions and gave the council his impression of the conflict between a group of council members and the mayor and his staff.
I feel that this has become a battle instead of what is best for Colville City. I don't give a hell who wins the battle, who wins the war. Colville City has a lot of challenges coming before them. Let's concentrate on what is best for our city. Please.
The biggest one is Hidden Meadows Ranch, a development in the works from Larry H. Miller Real Estate. The company's asking for Colville to annex some 300 acres of land south of town for the project. Council members Wood and Willoughby have proposed the new strategic planner position in part to make sure the city has the capacity to handle the application. The city's current planning official, Community Development Director Don Sargent, says he hasn't seen both his role and a strategic planner exist in any community the size of Colville, which has roughly 1,500 residents. He thinks it might be redundant day to day.
I really believe the position should be, in my opinion and experience, a specialized firm that when there's a project that comes before the city that needs specialized expertise, that person or firm then could be considered to help out with that specific project in coordination with community development director, but have the strategic planner on a day-to-day basis. I don't think it's needed. I think it'd be a waste of taxpayer money.
City Attorney Sheldon Smith said he was satisfied with the part of the new ordinance that states the mayor appoints and the council confirms the attorney. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Here with a debrief is Jeremy Rebell. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. How are you today?
Jeremy, pretty fair for what is not warm enough for springtime from my perspective. Jeremy, I want to go back before we get to last night's meeting. There were some contentious sessions a couple of weeks ago surrounding the ranked choice voting issue, and it was followed by some strongly worded editorials and letters from others, including former council member Max Doylny. What is your perspective on how that all played out, and do you think there was long-term damage done to the collegial relationships among the council members?
Yeah, fair question, Roger, and a tough one to answer in a couple minutes here.
We have time. Go ahead.
High level, you know, the council as a whole, and I think it's fair to speak for everyone on this, does not favor civil discourse, right? It's not good for anybody. It's good to have positive disagreements. There's five of us for a reason, plus the mayor. We work together to come up with the best solutions for the city, and every one of us works as hard as we can, putting our head down to do that. It was a bit unfortunate to see some of that surface a few weeks ago. It felt very emotional and detracted from the issues at hand. That's not positive for the community. I'd say specifically to answer your question, there were a number of accusations and mischaracterizations that we don't have to get into. Again, it wouldn't be productive. And, you know, I always think back to that Obama quote, right, from Michelle there of, when they go low, we go high. Ideally, there is no they in this situation, and we hope to work that out of the system here moving forward.
Okay. And I believe you, maybe I misheard you, believe you meant to say that you do believe in civil discourse.
Yeah, I apologize. I apologize. We don't believe in the negativity.
In uncivil discourse. Yeah, okay. I didn't want
discourse.
That hanging out yeah. there for you. Okay.
Yeah, apologies.
All right, so next question. The budget was discussed, and in particular, I think you teed off on a bit of a discussion about golf fees. Tell us a little bit about what's going on, and I sense there's some passion in the community about this issue.
Yeah, pun intended, right?
Exactly.
There is some passion. This is really a larger fiscal policy conversation around how we handle recreation. We talked about ICE a little bit last night also, and we talked about consistency across our recreation offerings, which traditionally we look at as golf, the MARC, and the ICE facility. One of our community priorities and strategies is always to push recreation, right? People are here, they love recreation, and we want to promote that and make those offerings available. We have capacity issues, right? Our local taxpayers, historically, especially in the past few years, as things have ramped up, have had a hard time using those facilities that they pay for, essentially. So the council's been working to prioritize that access, let's say. And part of that is looking at our pricing strategy and where city taxpayers are subsidizing operations of these facilities that they may or may not have access to use when they're looking to use them. And that's really what it's about. Specifically on golf, the conversation there is that golf is an enterprise fund, which means it's supposed to break even every year. However, historically, our city facilities have not paid for their water. So that money has to be covered by someone else. In this case, water ratepayers, which are those within the city who are customers of the Park City municipality. This year it'll be around a couple hundred grand. Last year it was a few hundred grand. And a couple years from now, our recreation facilities will be paying for their own water under the current policy approach that changed in the past 12 months. Another one is capital improvements. We had an item last night around asphalt and repairing cart paths, among other things around town. And that's paid for outside of that enterprise fund. So again, it's subsidized by those within the taxpaying area. So that's really what it comes down to is, fair access. And if folks are already paying for the service, should they be paying again? And should those not paying for the service be charged for the service? Now, golf specifically came down to an increase of $7.50 per nine holes. Take it for what you will. We're still the lowest in the area. Those within the Western Summit County School District area, as we refer to it, are entitled to receive that rate, as are any members in the golf leagues.
So what's the passion about? Why are people so upset?
I think there was some misinformation. For one, folks felt that we were doubling the fees, which wasn't the case. There were also some tweaks that had to happen to it. Initially, that discounted rate was only offered as a 10-pack pass, so it was $600. We've worked with our staff and reduced that to a 5-pack, so it's $300. They carry over year to year. Family units can use them together. I mean,
This sounds like a lot of there was misinformation that's created concerns that are probably a little bit overblown.
Yeah, I mean,
of course, it's easy for me to say, but it is if it's really $7.50, that doesn't seem like such a huge hike.
What we probably learned is folks are passionate about their recreation.
That's who we are.
We're happy to provide the best value for golf in the greater community and continue to do so.
Okay. City's going to be flying pride banners, notwithstanding the new law that restricted pride flags. Do you have any concern about how the legislature is going to react to that kind of an approach?
No, not really. We had our city attorney's office look into the legislation and give us a read on it of what was in bounds or out of bounds. And as far as we know, we're playing squarely within the bounds, so we wouldn't have any concerns there.
I guess we'll see how they react. I know you wanted to touch on Recycle Utah, which is relocating. What role, if any, is the city planning in assisting them to find a new location and possibly helping them fund it?
We'll do the high-level version on this one, too, because it'll get a lot deeper. So the city's been working with the county. There's a historic deal where the county is granting the city a property over in the Gilmore area by US 40. We've been discussing that as a potential home for Recycle Utah, and working with Recycle Utah, there's been a lot of starts and stops. This was discussed in a joint meeting with the county a month or two back. I believe it was said last night it's on the agenda for the upcoming one towards the end of June here in about a month. And also to expect a memo from staff, from city staff regarding a plan forward. Big picture, in about 12 months, Recycle Utah has to stop collecting. Well, at least stop collecting and then gone shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. And that would have a significant negative impact on the community, not just from a sustainability and values perspective, also from a financial perspective. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars a year initially, tens of millions if the landfill fills up. This is really a burning platform type issue at this point. And we need to address it. It sounded like the council was supportive of shaking this thing loose and doing whatever we could. And we'll need to work with our partners over at the county to make that happen. We can't do it alone.
Where would you expect the new Recycle Center to end up, if you had to guess at this point?
Somewhere that's easily accessible throughout the county, essentially, especially around the population centers. So, as mentioned, that Gilmore parcel is a good possibility. Yeah. It's accessible, and the area uses seem to fit it. There's potentially some other sites that could work as well. The Bonanza District, as it's being redeveloped, is probably not the right long-term home. However, one of the things city staff is looking at are these localized collection centers. So to make it easier and more efficient for folks in different communities to handle their recycling, which would be awesome.
So a localized center might be, is that a fancy word for maybe a couple of dumpsters? I mean, essentially?
I'm probably the wrong guy to answer that question.
Okay.
I think it might be a little bit more than that.
Okay.
But really a hub and spoke type model.
I want to talk about the 5-acre parcel, because we've been talking about that for a long time. And I know last year you and I had a conversation where everyone was saying, okay, we're going to get something done. The first conceptual drawings were made available to the public, and I know you guys have looked at it. I guess I want to get your take on whether the two approaches that you saw, are they consistent with what you had hoped to see?
That's a tough one to answer. I mean, so at this point in the process, we're looking for viability of a partner who can develop the site with us. The responses received were on point to what was asked for. They were asked to maximize housing units. They were asked for deep affordability, community gathering space, underground parking. We kind of threw the gamut of constraints at this. I would say I'm not surprised by the responses. The next step in the process would be then to work with a selected partner to refine them and negotiate these things and move the pieces around the board, so to speak. from a personal opinion perspective, they came across as a bit too dense, I would say.
Clunky?
Yeah, maybe a little clunky, the look and feel. But again, it's kind of what we asked for as a starting point. And it's just that. It's a starting point to then really get to the ultimate state of that vision. And again, speaking for myself, I'd say we're not quite at what that vision is realized as yet. But we are on the path to get there.
What you're saying, and I take it, is that there were a lot of constraints put on what you were asking for. And what came back didn't, at least when I looked at the pictures and looked at the information on the two proposals, neither of them looked like these, oh my God, this is a signature thing that the whole world is going to look at and say, what an amazing thing Park City has done. Neither of them look like that. And maybe you can't do that with the parameters we put on. But isn't that, again, when we go back to the original Arts and District concept, isn't that what we thought we were going to do?
Yeah.
And things change, but...
Things do change, and I would maintain that we are on the path to get there.
Okay.
To that really marquee project. Again, you kind of start at one end of the spectrum of viability. The renderings are just that. They're rough renderings. They're not meant to represent final architecture. The siting and where those buildings are on there are not meant to necessarily represent the final solution. We talked during the public meeting about, you know, what if we worked with one of the partners on opening up the entry corridor so it was more visually attractive and you could see the mountains. And they responded, sure, we'd be happy to do that. Yeah. So those kinds of things would be upcoming here in the process. What is encouraging is that we saw some creative financing approaches. One of the things that derailed this years ago was the price tag in the hundreds of millions range. And now we're talking in the tens of millions range, which is very promising and much more realistic. So things are looking up. We're not at the finish line, and folks should know that it's acknowledged that there's a lot of work left to do here.
How far away do we think the finish line is? When would you expect to see a shovel in the ground? When would you hope to see a shovel in the ground? I'll give you an easier question.
Well, frankly, I hoped to see a shovel in the ground 3 years ago. Unfortunately, I was on the losing side of a council vote at that time to go forward with a revamp of that 2+ year community engagement process, and don't necessarily think we gained all that much out of it. We were probably about where we were when we started. However, moving forward, you know, as quickly as we can, everyone wants to move this forward with purpose. Hopefully it's not more than a few months, certainly by the end of the year, hope to have something that's moving forward. And realistically, it has to go through the Planning Commission. I mean, there's a lot of process ahead of us. Don't have a date to give you. One of the proposers during the public meeting discussed a timeline and comparable projects. And I believe they said anywhere in the 2.5 to 5 year range from beginning to end.
And just so our listeners can get a sense of it, let's run through just what the next steps would be and how that process will go from here.
So that probably gets a little bit into the procurement issues at the moment. And so since we're in the middle of that process.
As an old procurement lawyer, I will change the subject.
Thank you.
To save you from getting into treacherous waters. Okay. Did you want to touch on Save People, Save Wildlife before we go? Because I know that came up last night as well.
Sure. Yeah, that was a really exciting discussion. There's a lot going on with UDOT. We're partnering with them on a number of fronts. The Save People, Save Wildlife discussion was around wildlife fencing in the 224 corridor. Anyone who drives up and down there has seen the issues with wildlife collisions. What can we do to solve it? And the city working with Save People, Save Wildlife directed moving forward here, form a closer relationship, leverage the good work that organization's doing. They're really looking out for something that matters a lot and is a deep concern for many of us. It's exciting.
Okay, Jeremy, before we go, I suspect you knew I was going to ask you this. Are you running for re-election or for mayor?
Well, I'll tell you, Roger, the deadline to file is the first week of June. I'd encourage anyone interested to get out there and do so. You do have to file in person, and there's information on the city website. I think I'll put myself in that same bucket of folks who should consider what they can give back to the community, and if you feel this is a way to make an impact, please show up and file. The more opinions, the better.
Okay, so that was an emphatic non-answer, which I appreciate, and I'll continue to ask you the question, and sooner or later you're going to decide I take it by the first week in June.
That would be the case.
All right. Jeremy McBell, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Well, the calendar tells us that boating season is here no matter what Cedric Hayes says. But on the phone to talk about boat safety is Ty Hunter, Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation Boating Program Manager. Good morning, Ty, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for this opportunity.
So let's talk about a little bit about the universe that you live in. Can you just give us a sense of how many lakes and rivers are available for boating in Utah?
Wow. You know, I'm going to say for being, you know, and this is one of the things I'm going to say here, is being either the second dry state or the fourth or the fifth dry state, Utah is really has been blessed with the forethought of having impoundments built and stuff. We are really water recreation rich with it. So with that, I mean, we've got state parks, we've got federal areas, we have national park areas. And we have a plethora from desert, one-of-a-kind, world-renowned Lake Powell, all the way to high-elevation alpine fish lake, to just an amazing fishery and amazing views at Fleming Gorge. So, I mean, it's just there. And then if somebody's a sailor and they want to get on a Great Salt Lake, there's a million acres out there for them to go on and sail on.
So we got lots of water, and with lots of water, we also have some danger. Let's start with life jackets. How important are life jackets?
They're basically your seatbelt of the sea with that. I like to try to utilize that because, you know, probably you and I growing up with this, we may not have we kind of transitioned into wearing seatbelts. And so we want to have folks to have them kind of take this cognitive thinking here and saying, if I wore a seatbelt to go to the reservoir, to the lake, why wouldn't I want to put my life jacket on to make sure that I'm safe while I'm there? And then I can get back in my vehicle and wear my seatbelt and try to keep myself safe on the way home.
So let me follow up on that. To some extent, just as with seatbelts, when they first came out, they were not required by law. What is the current state of the law in Utah with respect to life jackets?
So the current state of the law right now are children that are 12 years of age and younger are required to wear. Sorry about allergies right now, but
back to our meteorologists. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, with that. But with that being said, so 12 and younger have to wear. Anybody that is on a personal watercraft has to wear a life jacket. Anybody that is in a towed sports or being towed behind a boat, and that's towed sports that includes surfing, wake mm-hmm. surfing, they have to wear a life jacket with that. And then anybody that is on a river has to wear a life jacket also. So what this spells out is if you're on a lake and reservoir and you're over 12 years of age and not being in an activity on a personal watercraft in a boat, then that is a voluntary wear. And the sad thing is that we see voluntary wear in the state at about 6.8%.
Mm. How do you get that data?
a lot of that we kind of go through from our officers. When they mm-hmm. do inspections, they make contacts on the lakes and reservoirs. They're asking, you know, they're observing the number of people, they're observing the number of people that are required to wear and those that are not required to wear, and that's how we kind of start to extrapolate that data.
Okay, so what's the downside? How often do we see fatalities or are there also serious injuries associated with not wearing life jackets?
Well, the biggest thing is it's not wearing a life jacket. Utah is considered a cold water state. I mean, even though our water is at 80 degrees, that's still, in essence, 20 degrees less than our body temperature is. So the water stills our body temperature. So with that being said, we have some things that if you've ever jumped in the cool water on a warm day, it kind of takes your breath away. So that's mm-hmm. a little bit of that cold water shock that hits. And a lot of times they'll, like this time of year, excuse me, with this time of year, geez, I'm sorry, Roger.
Oh, that's okay.
Anyway, with this time of year, we have very, very cold water. I mean, we're in the 40s and 50s in our water temperatures right there. And when you're going into the water, you're getting that shock response. And what it is it's basically hyperventilation. Mm. If anybody's ever had somebody dump a cold bucket of water on you, you do that gas that, you know, you kind of have. And that being in the water and having that hyperventilation piece, if you don't have something to help you float, there's a good chance that you're going to start to aspirate water into your lungs and then complicate your breathing. That even makes it worse. And at that point in time, it's very, very hard to tread water. And that's where we start to see a lot of cold water drownings.
How often do we see issues with intoxication on the water, alcohol use, and are there legal restrictions on that?
Well, unfortunately, we see a lot with that. But what we're saying is legal restrictions of that is a vessel is considered a motor vehicle. So An open container can be issued and can be found and cited with that. A DUI, it is the exact same ramifications, exact same penalties as it is on the road. So it's a little bit harder because there's not lines and other things out there in the water, but you can look at how a person is operating. Sometimes, either delayed or maybe a little aggressive or not really being in essence aware of their surroundings. That can play in, and an officer can go ahead and stop and proceed through of trying to get the clues and perform tests if they need to.
That is really interesting. So theoretically, an open container on a boat, even if it was like, I suppose, standing still, would be a violation.
It can. Now, wow. There is a caveat. It is treated a lot like if you'd say a motorhome or a limousine.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It cannot be in the driver's area with that.
Okay.
So that's the caveat that's there, but it is the same.
I can hear our listeners breathing a sigh of relief.
yes, there is some of there with that, but the thing is it needs to be out of reach from the operator, and really the operator, frankly, needs to not be partaking of the festivities for the day. Their job is to operate that boat and take care of their passengers they have on board.
Let's talk about other dangers. What kinds of dangers do people encounter on our rivers and streams?
Really, the big ones, I mean, if we're going to talk rivers and streams, it's just fast-flowing water. It's there. It's mesmerizing to look at. A lot of people will walk up the bank. They'll look, watch the water. They'll try to throw something in, see how fast the water's moving. Sometimes getting that close to be able to do those types of things, that's when you're going to get in trouble. The banks may be undercut. Somebody could fall in. This happens a lot with children. And then we start seeing people going in after to help and save them. Sometimes the child is saved. Sometimes they are not. And a lot of times the rescuers sometimes make it out also. So, I mean, that's the big thing we want to look at is the dangers is that swift water. It's moving. It is usually in the stream bed there, and there are a lot of factors in there from the rocks, the other debris, logs, roots that are there that you can get caught up into. So the biggest thing is if you do find yourself in the water, keep your feet pointed down, keep your head above water the best that you can, and try to make it to the side. With water, it is awfully hard to swim in, and it takes somebody with training and a life jacket to be able to do so. So if you're neither of those individuals that have not, you don't have a life jacket and you don't have the proper training, stay out of the water and let it subside.
That's an interesting tip, the importance of keeping your feet down.
Yeah, downstream. That is the where you can kind of push off of mm-hmm. either rocks or the logs and stuff. But I am telling you, there's a name deemed called strainers, and that's what a lot of people get hooked up in. And once that water pushes you against the strainer, you're not getting off of it. It takes a tremendous amount of force to get you off of those, and you're not going to do it alone. So that's the scary thing about our streams. We need to be very, very careful. The other thing that I like to try to put in with this is, and I know it's so hard, is we don't want to multiply the amount of individuals that are in need. If somebody's in the water and they're in need with this, our biggest piece is that we are, don't go in after them. Go for help. Get help. Get the proper people there to help them out. Now, I know that is the hardest thing that you can kind of think of, especially if it's okay. Somebody you know or somebody you watch, your loved one, your child. That is hard. But it needs to be taken into this perspective. If that person had jumped off a cliff, are you going to jump off after them to save them?
Okay.
And that's how it kind of looks like.
not the happiest way to end our conversation.
No, but so. And I want to end this up as being happy with this. This is actually the beginning. This is Wear Your Life Jacket to Work Day. Mm-hmm. And then it's starting a boating safety week. And we really want to have people out there enjoying to have the smiles and the family fun. We want them out there and enjoying Utah's outdoors and doing those types of things. And if they want more, they can go to our website at boating.utah.gov.
That was exactly what I was going to ask you about, is where can listeners learn more? And you just gave it to us. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it. And please, everybody be safe and make sure you go out. We want to have you come to our recreation areas. And most importantly, we want you to go home at the end of the day.
We'll be right back after this. You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Be sure to tune in Monday. We're going to have a really special Mountain Money. The entire broadcast will consist of a conversation with Matthew Prince, his career, his goals for Park City, and other things. Fascinating stuff.